you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Donald Jeffries back on the show. He returns to discuss his latest book, Bullyocracy, How the Social Hierarchy Enables Bullies to Rule Schools, Workplaces, and Society at Large. Of course, Donald is a researcher and author. Among his several books are Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, Hidden History, An Exposé of Modern Crimes, Conspiracies, and Cover-Ups in American Politics, and Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Donald is also the host of I Protest, a weekly program which is carried on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. Donald, how are you doing?
All right, Tim. Thanks for having me back. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show. This book, interesting. It's a, I guess it's different than some of your other books, but actually it is a sort of a theme, sort of a... corrupt, bullies exploiting the weak little guys and all that stuff. So, bullyocracy, this bullying, you kind of focus on it's not just a problem of a certain age group. It's sort of a reflection of a corrupt or sick culture and how certain institutions encourage this behavior, not just in high school but after high school. And as someone once said, high school never ends in American life. So, bullyocracy. I'll let you talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, much of the, probably most of the book does deal with the awful, and that some of these stories are, hard for people to believe that I'm not writing fiction, but these things do happen, where kids are being, for most high school, for most people, and the high school is where the really starts, the middle school to some degree, but when they get to high school, the roles are established, and my contention is the social hierarchy, which is what makes popular students. And of course, without unpopular students, you can't have popularity without unpopularity. So you need the trench coat mafia types to exist for there to be a contrast with the shining stars and the people that are the celebrities. And there's celebrities in these schools. The popular kids are basically the celebrities of their little world. The high school quarterback, the prom queen, the prom king, the head cheerleader, that kind of thing. These are in every school, and they're given perks and favors that really reflect what we see in society at large that the wealthy get. And I believe that there's a correlation between popularity and they're the most successful students. Now, they may not always be the most successful academically, but in high school, the popular students are very seldom the best students academically, unless they happen to also be good athletes, which they can be sometimes. But for the most part, like the class valedictorian is usually not going to be the one of the most popular kids in the school. However, the big football stars will be, or the big basketball stars, the cheerleaders, the prettiest girls, typically are. And I believe that's what creates bullying, is that social hierarchy, because it's we've found in recent years that for a long time there was the stereotype, and people tend to think, well, bullies are these troubled youths. Maybe they come from a broken home. Maybe their dad's beating them. Maybe they're living in a trailer park and they don't have anything and they're bitter at the world. That's not the case. All the studies now show that it's the popular kids who overwhelmingly are the bullies, especially for females. This mean girls phenomenon that we saw since the movie that came out in the early 2000s, that exists in every school. It's a clique of a queen bee and wannabes, and they're all very pretty girls. And typically you have to be good looking to be in those mean girl cliques. And what we're seeing, and that's one of the first things that really shocked me when I started researching this, is I started looking at the pictures of these teen girls who had killed themselves. And almost without exception, they're really good-looking girls, very pretty young girls. And certainly in my day, I can never conceive of one of these really good-looking girls in the school killing themselves. You know, you think you're on top of the world just looking like that. But the reason for that is because they're part of these cliques. And what happens is they end up typically getting cyber-bullied, or maybe they get talked into sexting one of the popular jocks, you know, picture of them naked or something. It gets around the school and they can't take the humiliation. They can kill themselves. And so these were things that didn't used to happen 40, 50 years ago, certainly before the advent of the internet. And so I talk a lot about the cyberbullying as well. But so while most of the book it talks about school experiences and how we see over and over again, and I think this is the theme of the book, is that the parents will report to teachers, or they'll report to principals, they'll report to school administrators, they'll report to the media, local media, they'll report to law enforcement if it's bad enough. And over again, we find virtually in every case, the school administration, the media, and law enforcement will side with the bullies. They'll decide not to do anything, and the only time they tend to act is when the victim fights back. As soon as the victim fights back, then suddenly the teachers that somehow didn't notice the bullying, even inside their classroom, as happens inside the classroom many, many times, or law enforcement that didn't act, whatever, suddenly the world caves in on these – and they're punished much more severely than the bullies themselves were, and sometimes the bullies aren't even punished at all. So I wanted to try to examine this, why it's happening, and I think it's because – this social hierarchy that starts in high school, as you said, it goes into the adult world. I mean, these bullies grow up, and we tend to think they grow out of it. No, they don't grow out of it. They just become the most often when they go to college, they join the Greek life. They're in fraternities. And then we see the hazing rituals, which are just another form of bullying. And I point out, I go into this very deeply in the book about how many of these pledges end up dying every year in these fraternities. Some of the fraternities have been closed down. Sororities, the same thing, not quite as severe, but it's the same type of thing where you haze or basically bully the new pledges and it's initiation rituals and all that. And it's part of the same thing we see in high school. And I have documented cases, and of course when it's related to sports, mostly in high school teams, but you see it sometimes in college teams as well, where, sexual type of things, where they'll football players have been, caught inserting broomsticks up the butts of the younger boys and things like that, paddling them, all kinds of sexual things that are kind of homoerotic stuff, which they're kind of homophobic most of the time, so you wonder what's going on there. And the coaches tend to look the other way. Oh, this is boys being boys stuff. And it's all part of that same mindset. And then when you get into the adult world after college, then it becomes the roles are established. The bullying gets more sophisticated. And it becomes the bully boss. It's a little bit different. And there's a lot of practical jokes. I point out it's all part of that same family. Bullying, hazing, practical jokes. It's all intended to humiliate somebody, to try to make somebody feel bad. But practical jokes are an acceptable. Everybody accepts them. Everybody laughs and thinks, well, of course, we all want to have a sense of humor. But some of these practical jokes are hardly funny. And I give some examples in the book. So my point is that high school never does end in terms of that, because the people that ran the high schools, and there's another myth, is that when, that nerd's being bossed around, they're going with the pocket protector. But, he'll when he grows up, he'll be the supervisor of the high school player whose life peaked in high school. Unfortunately, it's not true. All the studies show that the more popular you are in high school, the more successful you tend to be in life. So it's another myth that happens. And I have a whole section of the book where I talk about celebrities and CEOs, politicians. And it's astonishing that the vast majority of those people that lead us, the movers and shakers of our society, were popular in high school. And I'm talking about people you wouldn't suspect. You know, most people wouldn't think of Rosie O'Donnell as her homecoming queen. She was. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a high school cheerleader. It doesn't look the part. You had Pee Wee Herman was a high school wrestler. Woody Allen was a great high school athlete, the quintessential nerd. He was a great baseball and basketball player. So the list is in the book, and especially like for women, it's astonishing. Virtually almost every high profile woman you see in the media was a cheerleader in high school. I mean, virtually everyone that I could find a background on. And I think this is why they translate so well to the media, because they're basically cheerleaders for the state, and they got their start cheerleading in high school, and they're still cheerleading. So it covers a lot of territory in the book, but I hope and so far I've gotten good feedback, because this is a subject, bullying, that it's touched almost every family. There's very few families that have been left untouched, whether either they were bullied themselves, they're still recovering from it, their kids were, they know somebody close to them that were. So I think a lot of people are going to be able to relate to this book.
One shocking thing is, I think it's shocking to most people, is that the behavior that you detail in the book, some might write it off as sort of the students acting this way, immature people. But you write about in the book, is often it is either overlooked or even supported by the teachers, the administration of the school, adults. There's no adults in the room in these cases.
Yeah, well, and even more shockingly, very often the teachers are the bullies. And I have many cases in there where a kid comes home from school and tells mom and dad so-and-so, Mrs. so-and-so doesn't like me, and she just doesn't like me. Or say she said these nasty things to me. Can you? And most parents, unfortunately, have the same problem we run into with conspiratorial type subjects. Most people have normalcy bias. Now, as a parent, if my kids had told me that, I would have been right on top of it, because I would have been able to believe it, because I'm in this different world. When you're awake to various things, you're willing to accept. Well, you're not necessarily thinking, well, the teacher has to be sacrosanct. She has to be this honest, upright citizen. I know that that's not the case. But most parents kind of, balk at that. Oh, come on. You listen to what the teacher says. Junior, you do what she says,
Mm-hmm.
Give her one for you. That's the attitude of most parents. But some parents decided, okay, well, they put recorders, either tape recorders or in some cases video. Recorded these teachers bullying their students. And even when that happened, and I put in the book, I talk about how that the system reacts to this. The system still is reluctant to, first of all, admit it, and secondly, to punish the teachers adequately. Almost all these teachers are still teaching that did this. And what's really sad is that the most vulnerable students are the special needs students. And of course, with the, with the vaccines and whatever else is causing the shocking rise in the autism and people that are kids. And again, this is why so many people can relate to it. I've already talked to a couple parents whose kids are, and almost every family now again is touched by that. You have a kid on the autism spectrum. Like every other kid has some form of Asperger's now, it seems like. There are so many kids on the spectrum, whether it's vaccines or whatever. And these kids are the primary targets now for bullies today. They're easy because they don't fight back. They're not socially capable, really, of mounting any comebacks. They're the perfect targets for bullying, and they're apparently perfect targets for bullying by teachers as well, because most of the students who were bullied by teachers were some kind of special needs students, which just makes you shake your head. Why somebody would go into an occupation like that when they can't possibly, how do you do something like that to a kid that has special needs? And there are examples of bus drivers as well. Everybody's in the system where the bus driver's teasing kids that have special needs or whatever, or enabling bullying. And the same old story we see, whether it's on the playground or on the bus, where as soon as one of the victims decides to strike back and finally say, I've had enough. And unfortunately, a lot of times the only way you can stop bullying is to punch the bully. And when you can defeat him, which you can sometimes because most bullies are cowards, then your reputation is restored and you're not going to be bullied anymore. Maybe you become a bully yourself. But a lot of these kids can't, especially if they have some kind of problems, they can't beat the bully up. So to say you just punch a bully, that does work. But a lot of these kids aren't physically capable of it. They have different issues. So you shouldn't have to even have that as any kind of an option, because the adults that are there, and that's the theme of this book too, is that I ask over and over again, because so many of these bullying incidents happen inside the classroom. There was a girl that was knocked unconscious inside a classroom, and I apparently the only person that's asking, where was the teacher? Literally nobody, the media, nobody asks, because that's the person that was responsible. If you or I gave a birthday party, and we were, you know, at our house for little kids, and one of the kids got knocked unconscious at our party, who's the first person they're going to look to? How did this happen, Mr. Kelly? Weren't you watching the kids? You know, they're going to do that. But inside the classroom, where we send our children to these institutions for 8 hours, whatever it is, every day, for nine plus months of the year, where they're basically babysitters, state babysitters, we send them there. The least we can expect is that they come home in one piece, or they don't come home terrorized, but too many of them do. I tell the story of a little kindergarten girl that came home from a kindergarten one day and looked like she had been in 15 rounds in the ring with Mike Tyson. And her mother naturally said, "My God, what happened to you?" And she was telling the story. Well, this girl pushed her off the slide or something that had been bullying her. So, of course, she went to the school. And they said, no, she fell. I mean, she fell. I mean, that's not an explanation. But this is what, unfortunately, parents – there's another kid I talk about that drowned at school in a school pool. I mean, not all high schools have pools, but this one did. And again, the teacher wasn't held responsible. And I don't, you know, the least we can expect when we send our kids to school is that they don't die during the school day. But, you know, that happened. And again, I don't think the teacher, and to me, you know, if he's drowning, he should have been able to jump in and save him. I don't understand how that happened. But another case I talk about, there was a kid whose body was found rolled up in a gym mat in the gym. And it's hard to tell from the stories. I actually tried to get a hold of their parents, but I wasn't able to locate them to ask them about this. But because some accounts indicate the body was there for a couple days. Now, this was during the school was in operation. The school's explanation was that he was looking for his shoes and he fell in and his body got rolled up in them. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing. It's like a UFO explanation that it's swamp gas. I mean, that's how the level it was at, or the planet Venus or something. And this is, I mean, just imagine your child's body is found dead at school. And the explanation they're giving you, and of course, the parents indicated that he had been bullied by some people on the football team for a while. And, you know, it happened, his body was found in the gymnasium, you know, the center of the sports world. But again, nobody looks at these things. And that's why I think, you know, I think my book is the first one really to call out these cases, because while you hear so many people talk about, you know, no, zero tolerance for bullying and all that stuff, no bully, the bully project, there's all these groups out there, but few, if any of them, appear to be looking at this, I think, to looking at it correctly. I'm looking at it from the standpoint that the schools are the problem. And almost all these groups want to work with the schools. As I point out, you can't, if you're working with the schools, that's like, you know, working with murderers to stop serial killers. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not, or having the fox, you know, guard the hen house. That's the problem is the school. The problem over and over again is teacher inattentiveness, the failure of teachers to respond when parents go over and over again and report this, you know, they'll name the kid or kids who are doing the bullying. This is what she's doing. And somehow they can't prevent it over and over again. And it's just unconscionable that this happens. And I don't know if I'm alone with wolf crying out in the wilderness, but the stories are heartbreaking. I mean, if you look through the book, and I wrote, I hope everybody, if you're familiar with my blog is Keeping It Unreal, donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. I write there regularly, and I wrote an article that didn't, I mean, I wrote a story, and I had this woman's story for my whole, it's a pretty long article too, because her story was, you know, it was like out of Dickens, 72-year-old woman, and she sent me all these details. It has to be read in its entirety to be believed. I mean, it's unbelievable what she went through, just a tortured soul, and it's amazing she's alive and she survived it all and didn't have an awful adult life. But just to keep it brief, she culminated this, you know, this litany of abuse that she endured throughout her childhood, being bullied. And her senior year of high school, they told her she was getting an award. She had never gotten an award before. So her mother and grandmother showed up. They were so proud. The principal called her up on the stage and gave her the award for the most unlikely to succeed in front of the entire school, laughed at her, and went on to say what a bad student she was. I mean,
what year was this?
This was back. Well, she's 72, so this would have been probably the 60s. I mean, I can't conceive of any time that the principal was involved, and you just, I mean, try to process that. That's the extent of this stuff. But these people like her, they're outliers, and they get they don't get any attention. And people just, okay, they laugh, they get their laugh, and they don't think about what happens to people like that afterwards. Now, a lot of people wouldn't have survived what she endured. They would have killed them. Today, probably, certainly, she would have been a suicide, because it seems like just it's more of an option now. You hear about it more, I guess, because she probably would have been cyberbullied as well, and that probably would have put her over the top. Fortunately, she didn't do that, but... And she has led a little bit more, better life than a lot of them. But I studied lots of cases of, you know, middle-aged adults that are still – that's why the cover of the book, you see the cover of the book, it's a series of montage of photographs from Rich Johnson, a photographer. We're talking about the faces of bullying. That were, it has all the marks. That it's very powerful, I think, that shows the marks that – they're not physical marks. They're not scars from beatings. But these emotional scars – and he has the names, you know, that are on there, this terrible names that a lot of people are called and so forth. And these are the things. And, of course, you can't even picture, like, the emotional slighting of just, you know, excluding people. People don't realize that it happens in the adult world over and over again, too. I have stories there of middle-aged women that are traumatized, still in their 40s. And a lot of them were bullied in high school, too. So they have that... They carry that with them, and I think people sense the weakness or whatever, and that they can do this to them. And, you know, it feels bad for anybody to have, you know, the girls in the office decide, okay, we're going to go to lunch now and make a big production of it and shun that one person. And it still happens, and it's kind of a mean girl thing. It's aging mean girls. And this stuff is going on all the time, but it's not talked about. And instead, it just gets under the umbrella of bullying, and people just kind of collectively – I don't know what they think when they talk about it, because I've talked to lots of anti-bullying experts too, and it's very disillusioning, Tim, because most of them seem to be on the side of the bullies as well. So I don't know who is fighting for the victims. I'm trying to in this book, but we should all be. It just seems like it's logical. I mean, there's, you know, when you have I've been told it's complex. No, it's not complex. If you know, when you see a playground altercation, you know who the bully is. It's the aggressor. Usually the bigger one, and the other kid doesn't want to fight. But it's invariably called a fight. It's never called like an assault, which is what it should be. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I talked to parents of children who committed bullicide, as they call it, who killed themselves. One was as young as 11 years old, and it's just amazing that what parents go through and how that – and it's all because in every one of those cases – I couldn't find a single case of a kid that was bullied one time and just went in and killed themselves. Usually this is a process, a lot of times years of abuse, and it's school inattentiveness, teacher inattentiveness, principal inattentiveness, law enforcement inattentiveness. When you're trying to say, look, this person is torturing my child, and they don't do anything about it. And so it's this subject really is, it may seem different for me, but it's not, because everything I write is trying to expose corruption, trying to expose wrongdoing, and fighting for the little guy. And obviously the little guys in this context are all the bullied victims, whatever their ages are, because they're basically, you know, we give tremendous sympathy, understandably, to victims of child sexual abuse. you know, when someone's raped or sexually assaulted as a child, we don't tell them to toughen up and get over it. We understand that's not the proper thing to say, but there's a lot of evidence that people that are really bullied relentlessly are just as scarred as people who are sexually abused. And we tell them to toughen up. That's just part of childhood. That just happens. Grow out of it.
Well, how would you distinguish some of the horrific accounts that you detail in your book and say the normal stuff that a child will go through in school? I mean, I remember growing up, I went through several schools, and invariably, being the new kid, you would be challenged. And this is the seventh, eighth grade. And you'd fight it out for a little while and then settle down and you get accepted. Right. Or just knowing how to cope with a bully. Growing up, I coped with a couple of them, and one of them was just not standing down. One of them was just sort of outwitting him, and they just decide you're not easy quarry, so they leave you alone. How would you just see, a lot of people listening to this will say, well, you know, kids have to grow up to learn to defend themselves. Being too overly protective and then being dismissive of these cases that are just extreme. How would you kind of strike that balance?
Well, first of all, I think what you're talking about, and in my day as well, was these things, it sounds like, probably took place out of earshot or sight of adults, mostly.
Well, playground or after school.
It gets worked out by itself. You're right. But that's horseplay, and typically, I don't know how you can prevent that. That's human nature.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about was when you're in a controlled environment, because everything I talk about happens within the facilities or on the playground. Now, the playground of school is different than the playground when you're just out on the sandlots and you're playing with your friends, which kids actually don't do much anymore. You know, everything's organized now. You don't really get pickup games together like in the past, or just go play tag in the neighborhood or something. Most of the time you arrange play dates, or you're in organized sports or in dance class or whatever. But when you're on the playground at school and a lot of this stuff happens there, there's always an adult there, always. Even in sixth grade in elementary school, there's adults out there. These kids are never left unsupervised. So things that happen on the playground, and again, I note over and over again, you can say, well, the teacher can't be everywhere at once. That's true, but they always seem to catch when the victim fights back. Then they're there. Like in hockey, where they're the second man in or whatever, but with a referee to say. So that's what I find amazing, is that they somehow don't, but that's one thing, but some of these things happen inside the classroom. I said there's no excuse for that. I mean, most class sizes are not going to be over 30 at tops. And most classes today, a lot of classes, probably most, have a teaching assistant in them as well. So there's usually probably two adults in the class. So for somebody to be knocked unconscious in a class or really bullied relentlessly inside a classroom, I don't see how that can happen.
Well, is this a symptom or a sign of a society in rapid decline and decay? Because it seems like a lot of these cases, the kids don't acknowledge like normal boundaries.
No, they don't. I think they know. They learn early on, the bully types, what they can get away with. I think it is symptomatic of deterioration of everything else. I mean, why should our schools be in any better shape than anything else? Because, again, the people in charge are either corrupt, incompetent, or both. And I would argue that most of the teachers are not corrupt, I don't think. But I would argue that they're incompetent. And I'm not sure what they're looking at, but I mean, I give you one of the examples. The first example I talk about in the school was, there was a terrible, tragic incident back in around 2000 or so, where there was a little girl in Cleveland that was shot to death in kindergarten by her kindergarten classmate in school. Now, I looked into the background of the kid. And, of course, he was from a horrific environment. He was living in a crack house with his uncle. Both his parents, I think, were in jail. And social services had been out, but somehow had let him stay in that environment. Again, all these, they were corrupt at every level. Social services, the same social services that will hound, you know, honest parents about taking a picture of their kid naked in a bubble bath or something. They'll investigate them and ruin their reputation. But something like this, they couldn't figure out how to get him out of the environment. I mean, they take kids that, you know, have they think their parents like Adolf Hitler or something. They'll take them away right away. But something like this, they couldn't figure it out. and the police had been called to the residence, didn't do anything. Everybody failed at every level, but this kid in kindergarten had been expelled a couple times already. He had been reprimanded over and over again for cussing, and he had even attacked other students, including the girl he eventually killed. He had stabbed her with a pencil before. Somehow he was still in that kindergarten classroom. And when this happened, when tragedy happened, no one talked about the teacher except me, because this is inexcusable. This happened inside the classroom. This kid came to school that day with a gun and a knife, and he was brandishing them about openly inside the classroom. Now, keep in mind this kid's record. That teacher should have had one eye on him at all times. This was probably the most problematic kindergarten in the history of the world. And somehow she didn't notice this. She finally did notice the knife and went and took the knife away and didn't even send him to the principal's office. And somehow didn't notice the gun, which he was waving around in the class. So he ends up killing the girl. No one questioned that teacher. No one criticized her. Nobody knows her name. I'm the only one even talking about her. And afterwards, they put the icing on the cake. Of course, Bill Clinton, I think, was president. Maybe it was the 90s. And, of course, he looked at it the typical, you know, social justice warrior way, saying there's too many guns. We need a shotgun. You know, that was his reaction to it. And the I think it was the...
Yeah, law against kindergarten students having guns. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. He bought that legally. But I think it was the chief of police or somebody that said we need to, the DA or something said, we all need to hug this boy. And I found the kid's profile now. He's, you know, a young adult. He learned nothing. He's either a gang member or a gang wannabe guy. So he learned nothing from having nothing. And of course, I don't know what you can do to a kindergartner, but you certainly can at least put him in some kind of juvenile reform or something and figure if you can reform him. But that's a perfect example that no one, and that's the most extreme example I can think of, somebody getting shot inside the class. But the teacher, to me, if I'm investigating that crime, the first person I'm going to ask, again, we go back to, it's a birthday party. Some kid brings a gun to a birthday party and shoots some other kid at your birthday party. They're going to question you first. You didn't see that gun? And again, this is the Teflon nature of teachers. No one wants to criticize them. And I don't understand why, because they're the responsible party there. You know, if they can't maintain the – and they, we're not – most of the time, we're not – I'm not talking about, you know, really awful inner-city schools. We're talking about – these are schools that are, you know, that seem to have relatively good reputations. I could maybe have sympathy if – you know, maybe all the students were armed or something in some awful inner city school and the teacher's like in the middle of warfare or something. But almost all the time, that's not the case. But nobody looks at them. And again, I think that's why my book is different and why I'm kind of getting a little resistance from the anti-bullying expert stuff, because for whatever reason, they want to work with these people. Well, if you look at the cases in my book, you're not going to want to work with them, because the teachers too. I mean, there, and the few times that I found that teachers did try to do, like one in one case, do something right. Now, sometimes they're too extreme. Like in one case, a teacher, a bully had been bullying everybody in the class, and she told him to stand up in front of the class and told everybody to come up and just, you know, slap him or something to see how he felt about him hitting. Now, that was extreme. But, and of course I don't know if she lost her job or whatever, but another case, I thought it was actually a pretty good idea where she brought the bully up in front of the class and she asked everybody who had been bullied by him to tell him how they felt. But I thought that was a pretty good idea, and she was reprimanded. So I don't know, maybe they know that if they try to go up against bullying there, this is the resistance they're going to get. But it's, the stories in the book are just amazing. I said, I can't even, you know, to try to think of the most extreme one is difficult, but people are not going to believe it. But I do think I've already again heard from that 72-year-old woman is the most notable example, but people who have dealt with this in school, and it's always the same story. It's always the same story. They go to the teachers, they go to the principal, the schools did nothing. Oh, that's the mantra. I mean, you can conclude that the schools do nothing, because over and over again, parents from all over the country say the same things. And in the most tragic examples, too often what happens is because the schools do nothing, the kids end up killing themselves, and their blood, you know, their deaths are on their hands, because they could have prevented this. All they had to do was provide and you know, not a like you said, a helicopter parent type. But you don't have to provide a cocoon, but you need to let them be kids. But that should never happen, where a child should go to school and be tortured like that to such an extent that they want to take their lives at such a young age. And we're seeing kids as young as 6, 7 years old that have killed unthinkable 50 years ago. Like that one parent I talked to, the dad, that the boy was 11. I mean, I couldn't conceive of an 11-year-old when I was 11. It would just be unthinkable that the young. But that's the world we live in now, and I think that once they hear about other kids doing it, I mean, the teen suicides rates are up to the roof now, and I think it's largely because of bullying. You need to look at the problem correctly to solve it, and I don't think that anti-bullying activists and all the schools with the no bully, signs and zero tolerance for bullying, most often they have the most bullying. And the parents complain bitterly afterwards, you know, my student was bullied and this no, they'll stand under the zero tolerance signs and things like that. So we need to look at it a different way, but we'll see how this book goes. I mean, I think it'll get a lot of attention from readers who've gone through this, but I don't know that we'll see if any of the people that they're involved in these groups, because I had to contact a bunch of them, and I'm not getting very many places. One of them put me on their mailing list. I said, I don't really mind being on your mailing list, but I was trying to tell you about my book, and I would think that you guys would be, if this should be the book you've been waiting for. But somehow I sense that they're going to, I know one of the people I talked to that wrote a book that was pretty decent about bullying already didn't, I mean, a lot of good people have written blurbs. Jesse Ventura wrote the blurb on the back cover, and I think Naomi Wolf's going to write a blurb, but this particular person said, well, I've read some of your book and I can't write a blurb for it because I believe that the bullies are victims too. And that's what you, and this is an anti-bullying person. And that's where you run into where they say they don't want to punish the bullies. And my point is, well, how are you ever going to hold them accountable? I don't understand it. It's like, you know, if they're not, and again, I think it's, they don't want to go up against the social hierarchy and, let's face it, you know, the kids that are the popular kids are usually the more charming ones, and because they have they already have the sociopathic or psychopathic traits that success, and we can talk about that too. There, that study that was done in England, I quote the results of that in the book, where they show that the occupations that have the highest level of people in them that have psychopathic traits are all the most successful occupations: doctors, lawyers, CEOs, entertainers, clergymen, well, police, of course, and things like that. The leadership, these are the traits people respect. All the studies show going to elementary school, and they've done polls with teachers and students, the bullies are always most popular kids. And the teachers know who they are, and they say they're the most popular kids. So It works for them. Why would they change their behavior? And it's, if they're male bullies, it gets the attention and the favor of the best-looking girls. The best-looking girls usually are the bulls. And so it's...
Yeah, that's to the extent here, you know, you, in the book, you also talk about high school itself and how high school kind of creates this environment. What we think of the normal high school is, you know, it's a institution, it's artificial, it's created. This isn't something that necessarily exists how in nature, or this is necessarily how, you know, young kids would develop it, you know, or get educated, many, and go in these large institutions, centralized institutions. Then they have, and you talk about the emphasis or the importance that's placed on sports and sort of athletic ability, and you know, the phenomenon of the leather jacket and the cheerleader and these things have. The players are supposed to wear a leather jacket if they're on the team, varsity, wear a coat and tie on game day. Why is that so important in an institution that's supposed to be geared towards academics? But sports has corrupted the entirety of education all the way up now from, you know, junior high on up. And this kind of supports the bullying culture because it's obviously emphasis on physicality and these things. And also... Yep. Who's being glorified here? you know, they make people go to pep rallies.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, people have no interest in the team sports, and they nope. create this artificial interest in team sports and under the guise of school spirit. I remember them making us go. I remember by the time I turned 18, I could just walk off campus and no one could keep me from going, make me go, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a certain culture that's created, not to mention the fact, I mean, I've noticed a lot of the bullying issues, at least my experience is, when you have a single-sex education, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, that's, I don't know if it's, yeah, I don't think it does as much, right? Because I think the, especially for boys, they're trying to get the favor of the girls. Mm-hmm. And I talk about it in our culture. You look at how many movies have ever been made in Hollywood where the leading man, now, of course, now a lot of times the leading lady, because you have feminists kicking in there, but the leading man doesn't punch somebody out. I mean, yeah. it's always stressed. And of course, we teach our kids. I've taught my kids that, but we teach our kids that you don't settle disputes by fighting, that might doesn't make right. But our society, all the culture, every message they get from the culture is that even though they have movies like talking about bullying, but invariably that's always resolved with overpowering the bully and beating him up in movies. But in movies going back to Jimmy Cagney and people like that, it was always punching out guys, and the dames, or you know, their dames were always there to swoon over them and you know fall into their arms right after they punch the guy out. And the message was clear that, you know, if you can beat the other guy up, you're right. So might does make right, and that's, you know, let's settle this. Well, how are we gonna how they're gonna settle it is to fight. So if you win in a physical fight, that proves you're right, and that's. That's just, I think it's a poisonous message for a society there if we're trying to really, you know, be civilized. But, and it contradicts everything parents
But it's a little sicker, though, if people are drawn to or attracted to a personality who is clearly picking on a weaker individual.
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately, and I talk again, that's why my book, parts of it won't be popular with feminists either, because I think male bullies are enabled. While you talk about the single sex in an all male school, they don't have that. Where you know they don't have the I'm going to try to show off and impress the girls by beating this nerd up, and show her how tough I am, and then she'll like me. And that happens so often. But if we had these young girls instead running to the aid of the victim. And saying, you know, get out of here, you know, leave him alone, that kind of stuff, because they're not going to punch the girl typically. But we don't see that very often. Maybe it happens sometimes, but for the most part, being an alpha male and showing that you can overpower another male it seems to win the favor of the prettiest girls in school. And that, I think, that's the part of the problem we see in the adult world. Again, I have quotes in there from feminists. I don't know how far you got in the book, but. There was this, and these are feminists that are talking about how they want a man who will take them and a man who knows what he wants and takes it. It's like, me, I can't, as a naive guy, I can't distinguish that from rape. But
nice guys finish last.
I use that quote in the book a lot. And you know, Leo DeRocher, who was a class A bully, by the way, yeah, he came up with that. And the fact that everyone kind of nods their head in the agreement, nice guys finish last. We all acknowledge it. And what does that say about our society that nice guys finish last? And I think if you're of a society where you're acknowledging nice guys finish last, is it any wonder then that bullies prevail in school or in boardrooms or anywhere in our society? Because you've already acknowledged, yeah, nice guys finish last. You can't be a nice guy. Well, I don't know what that says about – I don't think it's just American culture, but it's very sad because I'm a nice guy, you know, and I try to be anyhow, and it always depresses me when I see people that aren't. But apparently, a lot of people just aren't. They just they admire these other qualities, and the qualities that every bully has. I mean, there's a fine line, for instance, between aggressiveness and bullying, and just aggressive people. It's hard to be aggressive and not be bully.
Yeah.
Be a bully. And yet that's, I mean, it's sales. I mean, every salesperson that's successful is aggressive. Bosses are We've all had bully bosses. I mean, that's kind of what they want from the construction site to the boardroom of a Fortune 500 company. They look for that mindset, somebody who can bark orders, who can control people, who cannot practice what he preaches, because typically they're hypocrites as well. But we've all experienced that. So to a great degree, I think the people that are in charge, the people that are making decisions, are people that, if they're not real card-carrying bullies, at the very least, they have at least some of these psychopathic traits that mark them for success: aggressiveness, lack of.
Well, is the system designed for this, or is this just happening that something that this kind of developed over the years?
Somebody told me today, capitalism creates it. I don't know. I don't know how it is in other socialist countries, but I think there's something to be said for that, because again, that's that winning mentality. And I say this as somebody who loved sports, played sports a lot, and I hate it about myself. I love to win, and I hate it about myself. I really do, but it's just part of my personality. But everybody in America, we look at, like, for instance, coaches. I talk about sports. I mean, almost every good coach I've ever seen at any level is a grade A bully.
Yes.
They just are. I mean, they just are. So, but as long as they win, they get away. They can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to the coach. Now, if they lose, it's a different story. Then it's not working. And again, it's that winning thing. It's, Vince Lombardi said, winning is the only thing, you just win, baby, that kind of thing. And then there was I talk about cheating too, where so many of them cheat. I mean, there's one of the quaint coaching expressions: if you're not cheating, you're not trying. I mean, this is what coaches tell you.
And we wonder why there's so much corruption in sports and college level. When you now it's just normal to bring in ringers from the ghetto to save a winning football team. And this is true in the high school level. Never recruiting.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about the Little League World Series, where you had that, was it from the Dominican Republic, where that kid, I think it was Danny Almonte was his name, where everybody knew he was like 15 or something, but they brought him in as a ringer. And of course, invariably, if the players aren't white, then, you get attacked for, cries of racism and so forth. But all done, ethics fly out the window when you just win. You just want to win. And our society, I mean, somebody like a Bobby Knight, one of the most successful coaches ever, he was psychotic. And he could not have held a job in any other field. I mean, throwing chairs, punching players, hitting. I mean, he was a genuine nut. He would blow his stack. I don't know how he's still alive. I mean, who knows what his blood pressure went up to during these games. He was genuinely nuts. But because he won so often, he was accepted. Coach Knight, Woody Hayes is another one. Most of these coaches are like that. The successful coaches, and if you look at them, then you see why this. And again, that's so much of this is connected to sports. Sports means so much to this culture. And again, I think it begins in high school, where you see the amount of money. I talk about the new stadiums that have been built at some of these
West Texas football. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that they're spending more on that than they're spending, but they're not buying new computers for all the kids and that kind of thing. And it tells us where our priorities are. And you run into these situations where football players have gang-raped girls.
Mm-hmm.
And in all these cases, it's usually a successful football programs that have won state championships. The community sides with the players instead of the girl. They shame the girls. In one case, it was a girl that she was developmentally disabled. I don't know to what degree, but she wasn't, quote, normal. And they viciously raped her. And the community was on the side of the players. I mean, I don't know what you can say. What does that say about your neighbors? And how do you, it's hard to exist in a society that's that sick. But I have the examples in the book, and it happens. One of the mothers I've communicated with several times, her child was, her daughter was raped at, I think, age 13. And another girl, I think, was the same age, right, by senior football players. And they filmed, a lot of times they film these things now. So I said, you have video evidence. It shouldn't be any, it's pretty clear what happened. But still there's doubt. The media tries to cause it because they're football players. And as I say, if these were, members of the audiovisual squad, would the community defend them?
No.
I think of other balls, that would be, castrate them. That would be the cry. But because they're football players, I talk one of the more notable examples, CNN covered the trial of these two football players, and The reporter Poppy Harlow, who I couldn't find any background about her, but I would bet almost everything I own she was a high school cheerleader. You know, was anybody named Poppy? You know, but she was almost in tears talking about these young men, big football players, and their lives may be over. I mean, she again, nothing about the victim. And this is CNN. Now, the CNN usually act like that when a woman is on, you know, a woman is accused of somebody of rape. And if that, again, that had been a couple file clerks, you know, do you think she would have acted that way? But, and that's, again, I think we see everybody in our society, whether they want to admit it or not, they may blanch at the word bully. But when those feminists are talking about they want a man that takes them, when Poppy Harlow is breaking down in tears about the football players, they're all just like high school girls again in the halls where they're swooning over the popular kids, the big jocks. And it just translates over into the adult world. And I don't think anybody until me, when I'm writing this book, nobody has called out the social hierarchy. And I know it's going to be a tough road to hoe because I know people, first of all, you have people that profit. If you had I was like, you know, I wasn't picked on in school. I wasn't bullied, but I was like, maybe like you, the vast majority of people going to high school are like background players. We don't want to be there. We find it boring. You know, we're trying to struggle to stay awake in algebra class and things like that. And most of the teachers are really boring too. I mean, I don't know how interesting you can make math or something, but a lot of them didn't really try to do that. At least my teachers didn't. So we don't really want to be there.
Well, the whole structure is you're in class for 45 minutes, 50 minutes, a bell rings. And like a dog, you have to get up and go to the next class,
exactly.
Salivate. Then you have your lunch period. It's all very – the whole structure is designed to sort of psychological warfare.
One of the great anonymous quotes, and I found they're all the time when I found these anonymous quotes on the internet forums, they're always more astute and profound compared to the quotes from the so-called experts. But this one person was talking about how, yeah, exactly what you're talking about, how it's where you learn to be to follow rules.
But this is the whole psychology of a pep rally, mandatory attendance.
Yeah.
I could care less about our basketball team and our football team. Why should I care about these five men on the boys on the court or on the field? I don't relate to them. I mean,
exactly.
I don't care.
We don't. But again, what is it? Again, what does that do? They want a crowd. They want an audience, and that's what most of us are.
Yeah.
We're in high school. We're the audience. We're watching these festivities, and for the popular kids, they're the little celebrities. For them, high school must be like grand. It's like, you know, being in Hollywood and going to parties every day. And for the people at the bottom, the trench coat mafia types, who, again, the popular people can't exist without the unpopular contrast. They have to have some.
This has been normalized in movies, you know, whether it's Heathers or Can't Buy Me Love or Mean Girls.
Yeah.
And I know there's always some story to how the cool kids have to make friends with the nerds and that sort of stuff. But it's normalized. The story, the whole, you know, the whole atmosphere is normalized.
Yeah, it is, and it's probably exaggerated to something. Like my kids used to tell me, you know, that stuff doesn't go on in our school. Nobody's stuffing nerds in lockers and stuff. And I don't know, maybe it doesn't happen in all schools, but I do know that everybody in those schools knows who, you know. You may not, the popular kids don't know who everybody is, but
the popular kids don't look like they're 25.
No, exactly.
Hollywood is always 25 years old.
Right. But if you just wonder what that does to, you know, and that's why I start the book off when I talk about, you know, when every Friday in high schools all across the country, members of the football team wear their jerseys to school. So if you don't know who they are, then you do know. And I said, nobody thinks about what this means, what it does to them. How does that, you know, stroke their egos and build their egos, their self-esteem?
Well, why is that more important than, say, someone who aces a trigonometry test?
Exactly. Why wouldn't you have the members of the National Honor Society wear, you know, some big green hat or something? You know, because they're not – everything that the schools say is that academics are not important, that sports is number one, and basically being good-looking – because I talk about these really even something like a prom. What does the prom mean? The prom has become this absurd thing with these elaborate prom proposals, and it's another way where young boys can learn to spend lots of money on young girls. But and then you have the prom What is the who is the prom queen and the prom king? Again, it's just to lavish more favor on the same kid. Same thing with the homecoming king, homecoming queen, homecoming court, where they even ape royalty. You know, they always have a
I took no part of that in high school.
Yeah. And no, I mean, of course, yeah, I was, well, first of all, I don't think they had, well, maybe they had, I guess, I don't think they had a prom queen. I don't even know if they had a king. I don't know. Maybe they did. I paid so little attention to that.
They were starting that they started that in junior high. Where I was.
Yeah. Well,
which I thought was absurd.
Well, that's typically where the hierarchy starts, is in middle school, because that's when you switch classes. Mm-hmm. And you hear the bell like Pavlovian dogs, you know, you make sure. I mean, I still have dreams at 63 years old. That's one of my recurring dreams, and I'm not going to get to class in time. I still dream about it.
Most people do, actually. That's funny. It's always a nightmare, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. No, God, what's the teacher going to say? I didn't do this assignment and stuff. And I'm still thinking about that. But that's how strongly. I mean, I still remember, and you know, when you first. By the time my kids got into school, and my youngest graduated from high school, 9 years ago or something, 8-9 years ago. But by the time they were in school, you weren't required to dress out for gym anymore. But again, I still have nightmares about seventh grade gym class, because we had to dress out. We had to get stark naked. And of course, you know, seventh grade, some kids were developed. Some kids weren't. So it was a whole thing, and the ones that were running around, flopping it around. The others were running around, covering it up. And the gym teacher, you had to take a shower, and you had to walk up to him where he'd just sit there and stare at you and give you a towel. I mean, it was just barbaric. I mean, you think of it now, it's almost like, you know, I don't know what they're. Thank goodness, again, apparently they stopped doing it, at least in my area. I don't know if they do it, but.
What struck me was how often the gym instructor would actually pick on the vulnerable kids, the teacher.
Oh, yeah, sure. Slap them in the ass with towels and stuff. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. Definitely, they were. Well, gym teachers, you know, we had that saying, those who can do and those who can't teach, and those who can't teach, teach gym.
Yeah.
and so these gym. And that's why, you know, when you look at coaches. All gym teachers, just like if you look at security guards in most places, mm-hmm. they're all wannabe cops who didn't make the grade. And gym teachers are all wannabe coaches. They all want, and so they have that mentality. And they're you know, I remember, although I wasn't bullied, amazingly, I was an obese child. I lost weight right before I went to high school at the right time. But up until that point, I was really fat when most kids weren't fat. So I stood out. I looked like a little Eric Cartman. That's how mm-hmm. I was. You know, from I had kind of his personality too, but because of that, I could deflect. I had a really keen wit and a good sense of humor. I could make people laugh, and that mm-hmm. always helps. And that kept it away from me. And I was always really good at sports too, even though I was fat. So I didn't really get bullied, but still, I knew people knew I was fat. And the gym teachers didn't have any sympathy for me. And I still have nightmares about, oh, we're going to do gymnastics today. And then, you know, they're going to expect me to run up and somehow throw my obese body over this high horse or climb the rope. You know, we've seen that over and over. That's a real thing that happens, where they make the fat kid try to go, and you know you can't do it. And the gym teacher's kind of snickering. All right, then you couldn't, you know, they'll humiliate you for, you know, 30 seconds or something while the kids are laughing. And it's really sadistic. And I know that still goes on. So I, you know, maybe some of this stuff got formed with me at that point, but I really started. I think my mindset happened when my niece was born with Down syndrome when I was about 11, 12 years old, and when I started seeing how people treated her, even adults, I think I started looking at the world. And that's when I really started kind of having empathy for people who were more vulnerable because of what she went through. And when someone you love and you've seen adults, respectable adults, you know, say retard and laugh at her for no reason. I mean, I saw that as a kid. I was amazed because you see the darker side of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's So it changed my perspective on things, and I think I dedicated the book to her and my brother. My brother also went through something like that. It's kind of a complicated incident, but it was bullying related, and his life, you know, was never the same because of it. And I think those are the two reasons I was drawn to the subject, and I dedicated the book to them because I know there are lots and lots of other people out there whose lives were destroyed because they went to these educational facilities they're required to go to, mandatory, every day. And the adults in charge allowed them to be sometimes viciously abused and did nothing about it and were never held accountable. And still, it appears, most people are reluctant to hold them accountable. And I don't understand it. I really don't, because you're never going to solve this problem if you don't look at who's responsible. And in the case of, like I said, you can't stop bullying out in the streets or where the kids are. That just happens, you know. But although you can, you know, go to their parents or whatever, it happens. But I don't think that happens that often. I think most bullying happens within the schools or later, you know, on college campuses, and then later in the workplace where they're all authority figures are around and it's allowed to happen by those authority figures.
Well, Chris, an important question, and perhaps the bigger question is, you talk about a lot of the cyberbullying, the harassment online, on Facebook, a lot of these accounts, where with today's media and the internet and social media, you can't get away from it anymore. Meaning that it's the more that the kids are drawn into the internet, the social media, staring at that screen, and it's so much part of their lives, it actually makes them more vulnerable, which may account for the higher rates of suicide. Meaning there was a time they'd leave school, they'd get away from it. Now they're being bullied 24/7, 365 days a year because of the media. And maybe this will require someone like a Marshall McLuhan, a media analyst, to say, well, is the media changing? It's obviously media changes us. TV changes, radio changes. Now the internet has changed us. Yeah. And not to mention the fact that a lot of these kids are constantly watching either social media or like shows, reality shows, which sort of promote a psychopathic approach, constant fighting, insulting, down, trying to get one up on somebody, you know, Real Housewives or Cooking Wars. And other people have done studies on this, that a lot of these programs are funded by the Pentagon and by the intelligence agencies.
Sure.
And if you take into the account of media and the internet and who really created it, that it was designed, mass media is always designed for mass mind control or manipulation. That's one thing we know is TV was developed under this. Radio was researched with this. It goes back to the Radio Research Project at Princeton. How to create mass hysteria. It goes back to the Halloween Eve broadcast of War of the Worlds. That was done on purpose. That was a study. And so all this media, all these shows we watch, the kids now watch more than ever, especially the so-called reality shows. All this behavior is being promoted. It's as entertainment, it's being promoted, though. At the same time, they're constantly engaged in social media. And so they've become intensely narcissistic, also they become really, really self-conscious. You know, even more so than maybe in previous generations. Like when I was a kid, maybe going through, navigating these things, we didn't have the internet. I had a respite. In fact, I came from a big family. The school was always, the school was always marginal to me. It was always like, that's school, and I have my family life. It didn't matter that much to me. And so as people become more atomized, become more product-driven or desire to get things, image these things, they become much more vulnerable to these things.
Absolutely. And the cyberbullying, it really has taken it to a new level. And you have, because social media is a reality for everyone now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly live in. I mean, I'm plugged into that matrix 24 hours a day, almost ridiculous. And I, you know, I get distraught when I don't get enough likes and comments on the stuff I post. So I can imagine how the young girls are.
Yes.
You know, you look ugly, you look fat, and all it takes is that kind of stuff. But it's really inexcusable. And again, I talk in the book about how the law enforcement, the anti-bully experts, the psychological experts, they all will deny links between cyberbullying and suicide, even when the direct evidence, I mean, it's there. The posts are there, go ahead and kill yourself, I don't care, you're stupid, ugly, it's there. Or these kids will leave suicide notes behind, naming bullying as the reason they're doing it, and even sometimes naming the actual bullies. And they still will claim it's complex. And a lot of times they'll try to blame the you're already losing your child, which is tragic enough, but then it's compounded by law enforcement and the psychological anti-bullying experts, basically, and the teachers even who didn't respond and who are the really ones that are responsible, blaming and smearing the family. I saw it in many cases. Well, you know, it was family life, and I don't want to say anything, but there were, she had problems at home and all this stuff. And it happens over and over again. And it should be easy to find out who the culprits are when it's cyberbullying, because the evidence is left behind. And they still will not, they're still reluctant to do something about it. But, yeah, we can never.
Well, I think what's going on, why are they to do something about it, because to address the real issue, you have to get radical, get to the root of the problem. You have to start questioning the entire public school, high school system and the model we're operating under. You have to question the fact, as a society, we've allowed children 24/7, 365 access to media, which is virtually unregulated. Anything is this? When is this ever healthy for a developing child to have that much exposure, interaction with strangers, with media stimuli, and everything? And but that would require taking a step back and sort of undoing the past 30, 40 years. And one thing in the book you talk about how this is largely a post-war phenomenon.
Yes.
The automobile culture you talk about. That's a big part of it. You know, so we didn't have the, I mean, this didn't say there weren't bullying and problems in the 1940s and before. Obviously there are issues, but this is something that's uniquely American and something that can really, what we acknowledge as the high school, the cool image you talk about in the book too. Hollywood has promoted this, and this feeds into this.
Yeah, well, it's really with the, I believe teenagers were born in the 1950s, and I quote an expert on that, where you really didn't. There's no evidence before the 50s, and the first one movie probably promoting this was The Wild One, with Marlon Brando, who was one of the probably the first, a young Marlon Brando. He's kind of this motorcycle, part of a motorcycle gang, when the gangs were being promoted again, glorification of these. These gangs are all obviously have huge bully characteristics. They're looking for trouble. They're tough guys. You know, there's a mentality of, I'm just going to beat you up, and that's going to prove, you know, that's going to prove my point. But you know, it's encapsulated in that line he has where they say, you know, what are you mad at, Johnny? Is what do you got? You know, that's it. And of course, then it would go from there to Rebel Without a Cause, which is a perfect definition for all this. Rebel without a cause. And so the angry young rebellious guy, you know, whether it was Marlon Brando, James Dean, even the young Elvis Presley, these guys were kind of the bad boys. And what happens is almost all these movies, the girls, the main character, the lead actress, would a lot of times snub a nice boy next door or a nice guy and go for the bad boy. And that's when we really started getting this poison image of the bad boy. And I talk about this in the book, how they have websites about, you know, the hottest bad boys and things like that. And it leads to, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a mental illness, you know, and it would have to be a mental illness and it's exclusively female, where you don't, like, you're not going to have any males that are want to marry like a female serial killer. Nobody. There's no male in the world wants to do that. But there are females that lined up for, what's his name?
Charles Manson.
Well, it's definitely Charles Manson and the serial killer that I'm blanking on.
Ted Bundy?
Well, Ted Bundy, definitely. And the one that was eating his victims, I can't think of the guy's name, but all the worst. Charles Manson was going to marry a 20-some-year-old good-looking girl when
Jeffrey
he was 80.
Dahmer.
Yeah, it's Dahmer. Yeah, Dahmer. Yeah. And so this is the ultimate bad boy would be a serial killer, and the fact that any woman on the face of the earth would be attracted to that is very troubling. And that's when you get into, you know, in my case, you know, I don't shy away from controversial things, but I think, again, we have to understand what is, and I talk about the studies in there that show, they've done studies in recent years that show that females, they'll have studies of males naturally, you know, and this seems reasonable to me, that they are attracted by girls liking them. You know, they like that. They like to be liked, where on the other hand, the females, the exact opposite. They don't want the guys that like them. They're attracted to the ones that don't. And That's the weird. I don't think that's natural. I really think that's not a natural human biological thing for females. I think it was created from the 1950s on, where this message went out over and over again. You want the bad guy.
Well, it's like the desire for diamonds, right?
Yeah, exactly. You don't want the guy that's going to treat you nice and the good guy. He's boring. And that, what is that? It's boring. I mean, would any male, if you had a nice, sweet girl that treated you well, say that's boring? I mean, I can't think of anybody that would. But, and again, I don't think it's something where it's an instinct that females have. I think it's something that they've learned from all the movies and television shows that have taught them that. Of course, it started there, and now you have whatever. You still see that bad boy image being promoted now. And now it's, you know, tattoos and all kinds of other things where it is being promoted as being sexy. And I think that's all part of it, that because those bad boys, they always have the bully image. They're not, just by definition, by calling them bad boys, they're doing bad things, right? Mm-hmm. So, and again, I think it's so all of this, I think, is part of the culture, and I think we're all absorbing it. But before the 1950s, again, when teenagers were born, because until that time, that's the first time a media started catering to that demographic. And you had a lot of the great, I mean, I still love those great, you know, monster films, you know, the Monster They Ate Pittsburgh and things like, you know, that kind of stuff were giant creatures trampling cities and UFO films and all that. But they were always geared, you know, teenagers from outer space, that kind of thing, to teenagers. Before that, you never had films that were, you know, always had films for kids, and you still do, but not for that particular demographic. And ever since, and you talked about Can't Buy Me Love and things like that in the 80s. And I guess they still have them, but certainly in the 80s had a lot of those high school films that were 3 o'clock High was another one that were geared specifically to teenagers. And there was always a message. And the other message that was there, I think it's powerful, is that this kind of teenage angst, which was probably born with Catcher in the Rye, the novel Catcher in the Rye, where the character is Holden Caulfield is just kind of mad. He doesn't know why. He's just mad.
And J.D. Salinger had intelligence connections, so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he just kind of, kind of weird, where the guy was a successful writer and then just don't bother me for the last 50 years or something. Very weird guy. You'd think you'd want to keep writing.
Well, they were preparing the country for the rebellion of the 60s, the youth rebellion of the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where you can see where it started. It started with those types where you don't really know. There's no Vietnam War to protest. And you notice those characters in the 50s, they weren't upset at the Korean War or anything. They were just walking around, and most of their hostility was directed at their parents. Mm-hmm. Rebel Without a Cause, James Dean is mad at his parents, and the parents appear to be nice. But again, it's that they started driving a wedge. I don't think there's evidence before that era that teenagers hated their parents, but it's been so successful that there's not a teenager in America that doesn't start rolling their eyes when they get to be 13. At their parents and think their parents are the dumbest people on the earth. And that it's, I don't think there's evidence that happened before the 1950s, but I think all this plays into it, because that's the kind of the milieu that kids are now absorbing, and certainly with the internet, they're absorbing it a lot more, and they get to go on these social media forums and can express themselves and in any way they want. And of course, naturally being immature, they're going to start directing that hostility at each other. And when you see these, you know, I mentioned I get distraught if I don't get enough likes or comments. And certainly teenage girls that are taking selfies every 30 seconds, you know, when they're putting these pictures up, of course, what do they want to hear? Oh, God, you're so hot. You look great. That's what they want to hear. So when they're getting the opposite, oh, God, you know, what happened to your face? You know, does your face hurt because it's killing me? You know, that kind of stuff. Or, did you gain weight? Or you should kill. And of course, in most of these cases, I have the quotes from many of these cases where these kids are dared to kill themselves. And you probably heard, I guess, about a year ago, where the first case that went to court, where there was a girl that was texting back and forth with a guy and basically saying, "You're going to do it. Don't chicken out." And he ended up killing himself. And they took her to court. I don't know if she was convicted or not, but you may see that happen in the future, because it's happening more and more with these callous kids, and I don't know if they feel bad after it actually happens, or they just or don't have empathy. They're a little psychopaths, because that's, again, that's a huge, one of the big characteristics of psychopaths and bullies, mm-hmm. is that they don't have, I mean, you'd have to have no empathy. If you're taking a weaker person and, you know, stuffing his head in the toilet or something, you know, just crazy stuff bullies do, you'd have to have no empathy to realize, first of all, you're not, the kid, the person's not doing anything to you. He doesn't represent any threat. He's weaker than you. But of course, that's a big characteristic.
Well, I think the powers that be, want to incur, and I kind of alluded to it, is where why would the Pentagon have, you know, consulting interest in like cupcake wars? And look at the wars, everything's wars, right? You know, a cutthroat kitchen.
oh yeah I talk about the bullies, no. And the chefs, I mean, they all have Gordon Ramsay types. I mean, they're and people, you know, I don't understand it. And it's just like when Donald Trump had his reality show, so many people loved it when he said, "You're fired." You know, they got off. And I don't understand that. But it appears to appeal to a lot of people. And I think, again, the reason why bullies are successful everywhere is because they, even if you don't like them, and that's, you know, like a bully could say, you don't have to like me, but you're going to damn well respect me. It's that kind of stuff. And respect is...
I think it's emblematic of a society that worships success, meaning mammon, money, rather than truth and virtue.
Right, because until we let's look at it. The qualities that I personally admire, you know, I admire kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't say I admire meekness, but I like gentleness, gentle people, empathetic people, people that care about other people. Those are not qualities that most people admire. They're considered weak.
Mm-hmm.
Those are weaknesses. Whereas the qualities that turn me off, I don't like aggressive people at all. I can't stand aggressive people. Confrontational. These are bully qualities, but they're qualities of the successful. You know, they're the people that are, the rat race, you know, the expression, the rat race.
Yes.
It tells you what you're, you know, we're all fine. You want to be first in the rat race. You got to get ahead of the other guy. And I can't think of the guy's name. The guy from USA Today that was a first class bully. And he admitted it. And, you know, he talked about all the dead, or not the bodies that he climbed over to get to the top and stuff. And there's obviously that's the reality in the business world as well. And so what other than maybe, I guess, the world I'm in, the world of writing, although I guess they're bully writers too, but that's something where you can maybe succeed without doing that, because you're just kind of creating your own thing. But in most occupations, we see it over and over. I talk about the metal gun. Most doctors have bullying attitudes. A lot of nurses bully staff under them. I talk about it's a big problem. Certainly cops, police officers, we see the bully personality in full display.
Well, in medicine, it's designed with residents where they become, they more or less they're captured, and you can exploit them. They can work these 16, 17-hour shifts.
And that's the basis, going back to the fraternity mentality. It's born there where... And it goes on into firefighters and police officers. Most of these industries, flight attendants. I mean, all these. I've seen stories about how bullying is common in all these industries. And it seems to be the world of wrestling. They talked about a lot about that. I have the quotes in the book from people that it's, and they're almost word for word the same. And it's basically, we got to earn you have to earn our trust. We got to know that you have our back. And somehow you earn that by going through torture, going through initiations, a lot of sometimes, being physically abused. And after that, once you've agreed to do that and you join the fraternity or the industry, whatever it is, then you're going to be able to do it to the new recruits.
Well, that's the way of a system is preserving itself. It's like boot camp in the military.
Perfect boot camps. And I mean, every drill sergeant, I mean, by definition, is a drooling, snarling bully.
And people are entertained by it. I mean, everyone knows. Like everyone's favorite part of that Stanley Kubrick movie, What was it?
Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal Jacket was the first part when they're in the boot camp.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're being entertained by this bully drill sergeant who doesn't turn out too well for him. So,
but. and that's I think again it's a we but you know people respect that they respect.
Well, I think what it is they can say, well, you know, it's the military. You need to do this because when you go into battle, they need to be prepared for it. You can make that excuse. But the problem is they apply it to everyday life. And believe me, you don't want to apply the norms of military life to civilian life.
No, and that's why, you know, again, military, automatically, we see this in sports world or anything where just, you know, thank you for your service, all that nonsense. And where it's just automatically assumed, wow, you know, you're a cutter above. You know, it doesn't matter. And if you expose some of the things that these troops are doing, for instance, where Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, you get thrown in jail.
And God knows what happens to you there, which might explain why he's now Chelsea.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And solitary confinement, whatever, you know, maybe going back to prison again. But that, again, I said, I talk a lot about whistleblowers. This bleeds over to the political world where it's not just Edward Snowden and Assange and Manning that are they're the most high profile ones. But I have a whole section on there. What happens to people who are whistleblowers in any job? They're retaliated against always. And I talk about the whole thing about, snitches get stitches and all that stuff, which is a very popular expression where, and if you watch the old Hollywood films, the most standard, especially in the old gangster films where, whether it's Jimmy Cagney or the East Side Kids or any of that stuff where, you know, a guy will be beaten to a pulp, but you don't rat out your, you know, even though they may be murderers, they may have killed somebody, you don't rat. And in prisons, the only thing that's on a par with pedophiles are snitches, dirty rats. And what does that say? Because, I mean, I talk about how the difference between a tattletale. And so many teachers look at kids who report bullying as tattletales. I don't want to hear it. And I have a whole section on that where I don't stand tattletales. Well, what if some kid is, you know, is being abused or something and you don't want to hear it? And you're not even, and again, what is that? We talked about when the bell rings, this is where kids learn when they start switching classes, they learn to obey. Mm-hmm. They got to be someplace. But they also learn, they first recognize that these are government employees. These are government, basically your government leaders when you're a kid are those teachers. And they're all doing this on the public dime. We're all paying their salaries to do this, to not perform up to expectations, I don't believe. But they learn.
Well, you look at public schools as giant Skinner boxes. So.
Yeah. And one of those brilliant anonymous souls on the internet said, this is the first time where you learn that authority is corrupt. And that they don't do the right thing. They don't catch it and they don't do what they're supposed to do. Everybody, whether they, maybe on a subconscious level, but most of those people learn as high school students when they see the kids getting away with things, the wrong people punished or whatever, when they see that, or the teachers not recognizing a situation they should be, you know, getting in the middle of, they recognize, okay, these are, you know, the government isn't working for, they're not going to protect me or defend me. And of course that translates into adult life where your congressional representative is not going to represent you. You learn quite quickly that they don't have your interests at heart and, or anything, your military, if you're awake enough, you know that they're not fighting for your freedom. They're following orders and they're over. In many cases, they're killing civilians or raping or whatever in the, whatever lands they occupy in. So it's all tied in, the whistleblower, America. And again, I think the reason why there's this anti-whistleblower mentality amongst the people, you know, the majority of people, unfortunately, is because most of the people recognize that those whistleblowers are blowing the whistle on wrongdoing, and it ties into that, you know, whatever this wrongdoing at some level, it goes over into that bullying type of psychopathic behavior. Something's, you know, they're sexually harassing women, or they're tremendous favoritism, and there's something going on where they're stealing company funds, you know, things like that. Things that are more sophisticated versions of the wrongdoing we see in high school when they're just And it's I think it's all part of the mentality. Unfortunately, most people side with the people that are the wrongdoers rather than the whistleblowers, and that's a sad commentary on our society.
Well, except high school never ends, and the post-war high school setting was perfect for the post-war American empire. And
yes.
You have to, again, a lot of the discomfort is when whistleblowers or tattletalers is not only does it expose the rot of the system, which I guess upsets people's pleasant illusions, but it also kind of calls them out. And maybe you're trying to spur me to action. Now I have to do something. No, shut up. You know, I got my paycheck. You know,
Well, it is, and yeah. It's incumbent on, because all of us. I mean, my kids are out of school. I don't know if your kids are, but lots of people don't have kids. But all of us have to pay taxes. We all pay these teachers' salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a right to expect that, especially when it's our kids, but even if not, I resent the fact that any kid, no child should be going to an educational facility and enduring any of this. It just should never happen. And you can understand, the adults can't be, but you have security cameras everywhere now. So they capture, they have this Orwellian presence in the school. So none of this should be happening. Because once they know there's an allegation, they ought to be able to look at the cameras. Let's roll the videotape and see. Okay, well, they're telling the truth. And you have police presence everywhere in the schools now. But the police presence hasn't resulted, and I can't find an example anywhere of a cop stopping a bully. Because I think instinctively most cops side with the bullies. Because they have the bully personality in themselves. So you have the worst of all worlds, and then I talk about, at the same time all this is going on, you have these draconian rules where, while they're not protecting people who are really being bullied emotionally and physically, while they're not doing that, they're going after kids for the most ridiculous transgressions. They'll expel them for taking an aspirin. In one case, a kid had an asthma inhaler, which he needed. They took the inhaler away from him, and the rest of the day almost died. These are horrific things that are, we've heard the ones about the kid biting a Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun and getting in trouble. Or kindergartners hugging each other at recess and being charged with sexual harassment. So at the same time, they're not catching bullying. They're punishing kids for the most ridiculous things imaginable. And when you factor in all these hideous drills, I have a whole section of that are very real. And these are not Sandy Hook things like that where conspiracy theorists or whatever are involved. These are admitted fake shootings. They hire crisis actors. Yes, they do exist, crisisactors.org, to play the shooter. And it's always a scripted, politically correct thing where it's usually a demented homeschooler or an angry guns right activist or something. It's always that, it's never crazed Bernie Sanders fan or something. It's never that. But they come in and the students are never, and you talk about psychological torture.
Yes,
this is sadistic.
They don't tell the students that's a drill.
They don't tell the students. Imagine how mortified they are, thinking they're just, you have to teach them to, what do you mean? I've never been around a mass.
Well, that's like the odds of that happening. I mean, you got to worry about, they're more likely to get hit by a car on the way home, walking home from school than that, or getting in an automobile accident. That's obviously, that is conditioning, psychological warfare.
Yeah.
I was talking, a couple of years ago, I was talking to a mother who told me that they had a drill at their school, and the kid came home terrified, thinking, he didn't know that he was at risk of getting shot at school. Now I can get shot at school? Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. And,
thank you.
Sometimes, yeah.
Feel safe now?
Tax dollars of work, yeah.
And that, often they line kids up, and the police were like, at gunpoint, were lining these kids up, and or marched them out of. I mean, this is like, what are you trying to? I know what they're trying to achieve here.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it is the why the individuals are participating in the police is because they're paid to do it overtime.
Yeah.
The money is there to do it. I don't know if they're in on the big picture. But the big picture is this: they're conditioning kids for this type of treatment, being marched off somewhere. Just the idea that you need a cop in the hallway. When I was in high school, and there was no police presence anywhere.
Oh, I would have been shocked to see it.
Yeah.
But it's and So
and by the way, the doors are open all day. You could walk in. Didn't have to go through
a
security system like you do now.
Oh, I talk about one kid that was punished for being polite. He saw, of course, the doors were locked, and he saw an adult that he knew walking up to the door with boxes in the hands or something, so he opened the door for him. He got in trouble because he violated school policy. So it's amazing where they have these stringent, authoritarian type of rules on little things like that. But and you also have the kids getting arrested in school. They've had kids arrested for burping, for yawning too close to the teacher, for writing non-vulgar things like I love so and so on their school desk. They're being arrested, and in some cases they're rolling up fines. It's unbelievable.
They're gonna have drag queen story hour at the local library for kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you had that thing. SCTV had a skit called Library Police years ago. You couldn't have that any day, because they've had that now. They've actually had cops go to the house of a little kid that had an overdue library book. So
the library cop from Seinfeld. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you know, it's not satire anymore.
They found out like the Department of Education had a SWAT team.
Yeah.
Because this is all part of there's a reason for this. Funding was kicked in for this after 2001, and various inspector general's offices, the various bureaucracies, all wanted a SWAT team of their own. Then they got nothing to do, so they started dispatching SWAT teams on people who were late on their student loan payments.
Yeah. How about that? Yeah, sure. Can't go to those criminals. But so you would think that with all of this hovering presence, this huge state authoritarian type presence controlling all the normal student behavior. Certainly,
well, it's anarcho tyranny, as Samuel Francis used to call it, anarcho tyranny.
that's a good line. But
and quite frankly, as the social order, the moral order decays, largely aided by the public school system itself, what's being taught now, and the culture that's being promoted by Hollywood and by the powers that be, is you lack the moral order decays, you lack social order, so you get endless examples or pretexts for this type of clampdown, because society's decaying, families are decaying, so the normal modes of behavior or moral codes that we just assumed were normal don't exist anymore.
No, we don't. And you would think, though, with this kind of police state mentality where our student and with the security sign-ins, their parents have gotten in trouble for taking the kids out, with all this presence there, you would think that it would be impossible for bullying to prevail, because how would they not catch that if they're catching, you know, somebody yawning? I mean, how is that not possible? But somehow, this is the yin and yang thing. That's why I said the schools are doing it all wrong. They've got this police state presence. They're like veritable prisons in many cases, but this terrible bullying is worse than ever. And I don't know, I don't even know how to explain it. Like I said, the rabbit hole runs so deep here because, like one of the other parents that I talked to in more tragic cases, his name was Bailey O'Neill, a kid who was beaten to death at recess. He was 11 years old. And he wasn't beaten to death. He got in again, they called it a fight. And again, it was at recess, sixth grade. There's going to be some adults out there. Somehow they missed it. So, but typically it was a bigger kid that jumped him, and it wasn't a fight. He beat him up. They went back to class. He wasn't even sent to the school nurse's office. I think he complained, you know, his head was hurting. So they sent him and gave him an aspirin. Didn't even notify his parents. He came home, told him what happened, and he started talking about his head was really hurting him. So they took him to the emergency room, found out he had a concussion and a fractured nose. Ends up going home, gets worse and worse. He ends up going into a coma and dies a few days later. Now, tragic, 11 years old. His father, I talked to his father on the phone, Rob O'Neill, and he told me, he said, look, I went to the emergency room. He told me he had a concussion and a fractured nose. I know my son died because of this kid that killed him at recess. And the media got involved, and I have quotes from the articles in there. They were overtly poo-pooing that the fight had anything to do. I mean, you just don't die at 11 years old naturally. And they said, well, he had epilepsy. And they said his epilepsy was under control. You don't, in this day and age, you don't die from epilepsy anymore. That's ridiculous. But they tried to make it seem as if, this was before the social hierarchy should have set in. It was sixth grade. But the most incredible part, the rabbit hole goes so deep here, the medical examiner was involved. He held a press conference, and he said unequivocally, without hesitation, the fight had nothing to do with this boy's death. Now, I don't know what that even means. How deep does the rabbit hole go here? The medical examiner is involved. I talked to the boy's father. He had a concussion and a fractured nose. It obviously had something to do with his death. He was a healthy 11-year-old before that. So what does that tell us? What is happening here that a medical examiner can be and it's almost like a JFK assassination type thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are they covering up? I can't explain that. All I can do is, report it and sit there and I'll give you another example. There was a girl that was 12 years old that Rebecca Sedgwick that either jumped or was pushed off a tower in Florida after being relentlessly bullied for a long time. They knew who the two girls who were bullying. They had the names. In fact, for once, law enforcement there was going to do their job, and they were going to charge them with something. But the pressure from the media especially got them to back off. Yeah, the media was siding with the bullies, as they always do. And I communicated with Rebecca's mother several times. And I had an exchange of emails with one of these anti-bullying experts who was very much in the camp of the bullies, as they all are. And she thought she was proving something. She said, I'm going to send you the police report, the full police report in this case. I said, okay, good. Well, the police report was full of documentation of these two girls doing the bullying and how they knew they were responsible, leaving messages on social media, gloating, and all these things that should be evidence. So I emailed her back and I said, well, thanks for this. This is great. It just proves conclusively what I've been saying. And she goes, well, I don't see it that way. So I don't know what that means. I don't know what she's seeing, because it demonstrated conclusively that they were responsible. But that's 12-year-old girls. Why are they reluctant to hold? And a girl died because there's some indication from what one of the girls said that she may have pushed her. I don't know. But either way, she was responsible. But even in cases, like I said, where they named the bullies in the suicide notes, the anti-bullying experts, all the experts come out and fall all over themselves to say, no, it's not related to bullying. Now, what does that mean? I can't begin to tell you. I think it's all tied in some way to the social hierarchy thing, but it just seems amazing to me that when they're holding children accountable for, the things that have been going on forever, burping or, pointing their fingers like guns, hugging each other. These are normal human behaviors. We should want kids to be able to hug each other. But they're holding that displays of affection, all that. They're cracking down on that and stopping it. But they're going overboard in protecting these vicious, kids who lack empathy and have psychopathic traits and are torturing other kids to the point where these kids don't want to live any longer, even at really young ages. And I don't know what's behind that. All I can do is just sit there and report it and just continue to be astonished that everybody doesn't see it this way. But there are people that look at this and they will just, it's complex or something. I don't know what to tell you. They're telling you why they're doing it. They're giving you, so how you say it's complex, I don't know. But for whatever reason, you want this bullying. And I think it's because they know that bullying is enabled and it's part and parcel of this social hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have popular kids, like one of the most poignant statements, there's a movie called Bully made a few years ago by Lee Hirsch. And it concentrated on, I think, four different kids who ended up killing themselves that had been bullied. And one of the kids was 11 years old or something. And his little 11-year-old friend, again, more profound than all the anti-bullying experts in the world, he just looked in the camera at one point and he said, I wish there was no such thing as popularity. And he hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what the problem is. Now, of course you can't really mandate something like that, but because they are having these certain kids wear their football jerseys to school on Friday.
Yeah, it's artificial,
Yeah, exactly. Where they're giving them Letterman jackets. They're given they're in case you don't know who the cheerleaders are, here we because they're having prom queens and homecoming queens, all these things that are bestowing favors, bestowing accolades on young, impressionable minds whose egos are being formed. So it's blowing their self-esteem up so that what happens? They become conceited, and they start treating their kids who aren't popular dismissively. So at best, they're not going to say hello to you. It happens over and over again. I've heard many accounts where, you know, kids were, and we've seen movies about it too, but it's a real phenomenon where your friends and, you know, as little kids, and then you get to middle school and high school, and one of you becomes popular and the other one doesn't. So suddenly he or she doesn't know you anymore. You know, turns their nose up at you.
I knew actually a couple of accounts of that happened, you know.
Because there is popularity, because they know, everybody knows that one is popular and one isn't. So, but who enables that? The reason it doesn't happen, if there was no school, for instance, in the neighborhood, and I knew that, for like some kids who weren't friendly to you in school, if they were in your neighborhood, they still would be. They'd acknowledge your existence there. Because you weren't in the school, but in the school.
Well, it goes back to that school creating. It's the institution.
Yes, yeah. It's institutionalized. It's a social hierarchy. And I think it's at the heart of it. It's why bullying exists, because it enables those kids. It makes them conceited and arrogant beyond belief. And
high school was created to create this very situation you are spelling out here, which is why they're so resistant to addressing the problem.
Yeah, and they clearly are, because they, and I think that's why everybody is reluctant, because how many people in the media, in law enforcement, and
I mean, this factors in everything. If you make popularity something you desire, something that does exist, and therefore something to be desired, you can market that and sell product, because the product can make you popular. The car, you know,
right?
The right deodorant.
Exactly.
You know, and you don't think people who are in control of society have examined? I mean, it's become very scientific, the study of humanity and psychology. Edward Bernays, you know, the father of modern, you know, PR and propaganda, these things. This is how you rule over a society. And it's going to filter down, drill down into the education system, because that's where it starts. You know,
absolutely.
This is why high school never ends.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they learn it. Yeah, Bowling for Soup had that song, High School Never Ends.
Yeah.
And it's a nice song. And but it's true. And again, people, I mean, I talk in the book about, is there life? There was a book called Is There Life After High School by Ralph Keyes, which had an impression on me when I read it when I was young. In fact, he's my Facebook friend. I need to try to contact him sometime. But he talked about how like people like when they what's his name Phil Spector, of course, ended up, you know, getting went to prison for murder eventually, but he apparently was abused a lot in high school. Mm-hmm. And he felt so stung by it that he made this huge production out of going to I think it was his 5-year I think it was 5-year maybe 10-year, but he went there in a huge limousine. Very ostentatious. He went in and just kind of marched around and just gave everybody the air, didn't talk to anybody, and then walked back out or something. So it was, he felt the need to do it. And Kurt Vonnegut, who I quote at the beginning of the book about, you know, true terror is knowing that, waking up and realizing the people he went to high school are in charge of the country. And, he had a experience where apparently he was shamed by a gym teacher in high school, and he held on to it for decades, even after he was, an award-winning author and one of the great novelists of the 20th century. And he had to contact the guy just to let him know how he still was, you know, scarred by that experience decades later. And he said it was more cathartic than all the therapy he'd ever had. And people like Dustin Hoffman, who became a big movie star, he apparently, supposedly, still today, he still harbors really bad feelings about being bullied in high school. So if that can happen to people like that, just imagine the people, because obviously the vast majority of people don't go on to lead lives like Dustin Hoffman. Most of them are the kind of people I describe in the book. They end up as unhappy. A lot of them are never able to marry, or never don't have kids, don't have families, are lonely and bitter in their old age, and can never succeed much in life because they don't have any confidence. They have that defeated look of the victim that they learned in high school, and they probably fear, you know, they look at the loudest, most dominant personality maybe where they work, and just, it's, you know, it's like the lion looking at for the gazelle, you know, looking for their prey. And those kinds of personalities can sense, okay, this is the guy I can start playing practical jokes on. They can't really bully him like they did in high school, but what happens in that environment? It's the practical jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And the thin line there between that. And of course, then it's the idea is to humiliate them. And of course, there's always going to be coworkers around to enable the bully as they did in high school. You had an audience then. You got an audience in the workplace where you're laughing at. Maybe not as many, and some of them matured enough to say, that's not funny, that's stupid or something, but there's still going to be enough there. And of course, the only reason the bully is able to exist is because of that audience, because if they didn't, most of the bullying is done where others can see it and laugh at it and share, you know, sharing the glory. If the audience intervened, first of all, but at least so that's stupid and turned their backs and walked away, what's the bully going to do? It's not satisfying.
Yeah.
And but so they're so really we're the crowd is all to blame too for enabling it. But you know, you can look at it extends into the political world. The mob is to blame for everything, for being indifferent and allowing the tyranny and the corruption to continue. So I think this, even though it doesn't seem like a political issue, it is. It's all tied in the things we talk about with the whistleblowers and just kind of the learned behavior is to follow rules. And the first indication of you know what to expect when you're in high school. By the time I got out of high school, I had an impression of teachers, and it wasn't a positive one. You know, there were very few. I can think of maybe two or three teachers, and throughout my 12 years in public school, that made any kind of positive impression on me. For the most part, they were either negative or they just, you know, they were indifferent government workers that you knew that made it really clear to everyone they were on a time clock.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, I never sent, I mean, for instance, as a writer, even at that time, I remember I wasn't very motivated, but I remember I was friends with the valedictorian, a girl who, I liked her a lot. And she resented me because I could write. I mean, I would be sitting in the library with her, and we'd have a half hour left, and I'd just write, you know, a paper. And she, you know, she'd been studying all week, and she used to hate that. I mean, I'd get a good grade on it. But I mean, I at that time, I knew I could write, and but nobody sensed that. You know, I never had an English teacher tell me, "Wow, you have talent." Nothing. And I had it then. I was already writing stories and stuff, and I knew I had it. So luckily, I didn't let that bother me, but. You'd think an English teacher would be able to kind of see the potential, but I think it's because, again, they just weren't, they're not there for that. They're there, you know, they're there just kind of to keep you in order maybe and make sure you're there and they're, you know, take attendance and all that kind of stuff. Did you do your homework? That kind of thing. And apparently nowadays, especially with bullying going on inside the classroom, they're somehow not able to catch the culprits doing it. And you know, if there was the case of the kid there were some kid pulled a knife on a student inside a classroom, and a very brave fellow student ran over and intervened and wrestled the knife away from him. I mean, it was my kid, I would have been mortified they took that chance, but still pretty heroic. Well, what happened? Two things. First of all, the kid that wrestled the knife away got in trouble.
Yeah.
Because he violated policy. He was not supposed to do that. And again, no one mentioned the teacher. You know, where was the teacher? And in one other case where there was a teacher actually did intervene in a fight, the teacher got in trouble. Because their policy was if there was a fight, the teachers were not supposed to intervene. I mean, I don't think, what does that mean? I mean, so you just let.
Well, here you have a case where someone does exert, you know, physical exertion, righteous violence, because you could say, and that, of course, that's punished.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. And, he was doing what the teacher should have done, you know, really theoretically, but I mean, and again, where this ever present law enforcement.
You have to call the resource officer, who isn't anywhere to be found whenever.
No, never. And I have a quote from the resource officer. This guy, I don't know if he still is, but at the time he was like the the chief resource officer, like for the national resource, I guess the head honcho, the CEO's a resource officer or something. But, and I have a quote from them where it's just the typical pap you'd expect of, you know, bullying is complex, or, you know, clearly coming down on the side of bullies. And this is the guy, the resource officer, as you indicate, that's like kind of like the bottom level. That's one of the first points of contact for a student, supposedly, that's being bullied. Well, if their leader is imparting this wisdom to them that, well, you know, it's a complex issue and we need to, you know, that kind of thing, where they're not expressing the so-called zero tolerance policy, where, you know, that they do apparently utilize for things like, you know, no aspirin.
Yes.
No, you know, that kind of thing. Or, you know, you don't point your, you know, you brought a butter knife to lunch, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
that's the real sense of where a girl, she accidentally took her father's lunch instead of hers. And he had like a paring knife for his apple or something. She got in trouble. And again, they didn't accept the explanation. So I guess the one of the overall points of the book, I guess, is that our school systems are pretty much worse than anyone thought they were. They're not doing anything right. You know, aside from the fact they're not producing very educated people, because they're wasting so much time on standardized tests and this ridiculous rote learning and teaching kids things like you know, trigonometry and things like that the vast majority will never use.
Yeah.
Where they should be doing something like, okay, if you express an interest in history or English or math or whatever, to try to channel them in particular directions and not make kids, you know, for instance, if you're not, I mean, I hated math.
Yeah.
You know, like, and, you know, okay, well, you want to learn basic math, and that's all you need to know, really.
Yeah, I wasted time on, like, higher order math and failing or getting a D when nothing beyond geometry is really necessary, really.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, why not start channeling people into, okay, this is advanced computers or things, you know, things that may come in handy in the working world and try to prepare you, but they don't do that. Instead, they waste time with these meaningless standardized tests and things like math, especially, that a lot of people don't have the aptitude for, don't have the like for, and there's no need.
Well, the fact that if you like a class or a particular discipline or study, the class only lasts 50 minutes. Then it's off to the next class.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you talk about zero tolerance, what that does is encourage it. What you're saying is that the people who are in charge of watching your kids for 6-7 hours a day, they're not expected to show judgment. So
right.
What does that say about the institution itself, where zero tolerance? So you can't discriminate, or you can't show any judgment, or why am I trusting you with my kids if you don't have that capacity?
Well, I can give you another example. I mean, I was, first of all, I taught some. I taught CCD, and many times, and I've taught, like, you know, I teach a JFK assassination course now. Mm-hmm. I'm used to being in a teaching environment, but I also coached a lot. Both my kids played sports, so I coached girls and boys sports for a decade, and constantly. I was always coaching something, and I never had an experience ever where something happened at my practice or anything where, again, at those situations, it's just, most of the time, it's just you. A lot of times, few if any, especially when they get older, few if any parents watch practice. A lot of times you're just there, it's you and your assistant coach or whatever and the kids. So anything theoretically could happen, but anything that would have happened there would have been my responsibility solely.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't conceive of one kid physically harming another ever in any of my practices. I mean, I wouldn't have rushed over and understand. I could not conceive it. There was never a threat of it. First of all, I never saw, and that's another thing where, even though it's organized sports, if it happens outside the school like that, you just don't see the bullying. I never saw any bullying. You don't see bullying in the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts either. You don't see that stuff there. It's always within these institutions. Something about the school system itself produces it, because I never saw it once. And again, as the responsible authority there, the teacher, if you would, whatever happened, I was going to be blamed for. if something, I couldn't say that, you know, like that little kindergartner, like that stupid teacher told the parents she fell. I couldn't say that one of the kids fell and have them show up when their parents picked them up and look like they'd been 15 rounds in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
How would do you think a parent would have accepted that explanation?
But yeah, she fell. Well, how many times did she fall?
Yeah, exactly. She fell over and over again and kept smashing her. And that's the kind of thing that. Or let's say if the tragic case of the boy, if I had been I coached basketball, so if I'd been at a gymnasium and the parents came to pick up the kid and one of the kids was missing and I said, I don't know, and then they found his body rolled up in a mat, would I have been able to say, well, I don't know what happened? I think he was looking for a shoe, because that's what they said. He was looking for a shoe. So I would have been held responsible. Probably would have sued. And again, I wasn't being paid. I'm a volunteer. I'm a parent volunteer, but I would have been held under scrutiny. I would have been the first person questioned. But same with the Boy Scout leader or Girl Scout leader or whatever. They're the responsible party. But a teacher is somehow, even when that little girl, the kindergarten girl, got shot in her class, nothing happened. Nobody knows her name. Now, how is that possible? Can you imagine if somebody had, one of my players had shot another one? I mean, I would have been held responsible. What do you mean? How did you not see them waving the gun around? That's what I would have said.
Well, I think the answer is the system is, the results we're seeing is the very results that the system ultimately wants. That's why there's so much resistance.
Yeah, and it's because... And the social hierarchy, because so many people in our society that are in leadership positions benefited from it. They led great lives in high school because they were popular. They were cheerleaders. They were football players, basketball players. They were big men on campus, big women on campus. They were prom kings, prom queens, homecoming queens, whatever. It was a great experience for them. So they're not going to rock that boat because they look at it. They don't look at all the people that first of all, that are indifferent and are bored by high school and hate it just because they don't want to be there. And they certainly don't have any empathy for the people that are getting picked on because they picked on kids themselves, too, when they were young. So they basically the bullies are in charge. So, of course, they're and the ones that aren't, the ones that weren't popular in high school but have managed to succeed in the adult world, they're just as anxious to curry favor with the adults in charge as they were to be friends to the quarterback and the head cheerleader in high school. They want to be friends. One thing I found, even the phenomenon you see recently of a often really good-looking teacher sleeping with their young male students, I'm sure you see, I mean, a lot of us, you know, where were these teachers when we were in school? That's but can't even conceive of it, right? But
it's bizarre, yeah.
It's bizarre, but when I could find... certainly high school. I mean, I don't, you know, when they were in elementary school, I can't even figure that out. I don't know what the mindset is there, but in the high school level, when I was able to find out, and a lot of times you can dig a little bit and find anything about the boy who they can't name ever. Every time, the kid was a popular athlete, and so so it's again, is this just another perk they're getting now? Not only are they getting all these perks and accolades, and they're being their egos being fed, and they're becoming arrogant and conceited? Now they're even getting, there's a real possibility they're going to be able to have sex with the best looking teachers. So every boy's fantasy. So, but again, nobody looks at it that way. Nobody's, when they're saying it, it's, well, the women are monsters, and, you know, let's face it, we don't know what's going on there. We can't conceive of it, but it's never looked at that way. Okay, well, who? They're not just randomly picking on these kids.
Yeah.
They're picking on particular ones. And is it because they're still immature? They are just as anxious to be with the popular boys as they were in high school? I don't know. But it's an aspect of it that I think I was the first one to look at. So that's why this book has a lot of really firsts, I think, in it. And I think if people read it, it's eye-opening because you'll see – things like that, where nobody else has questioned these things in the way I have, and I think that's the only way to ever really find out what's happening, because the so-called anti-bullying efforts aren't working, and it largely is said because what I've discovered is that virtually all the anti-bullying experts are on the side of the bullies.
Yeah, and if it is indeed a product of the system, and you can't rely on the very system to reform itself. And it's, again, it's a result they ultimately the system wants. So, well, okay, well, the book is Bullyocracy, How the Social Hierarchy Enables Bullies to Rule Schools, Workplaces, and Society at Large. I guess you can get that at, is it Trine Day?
Trine Day, yeah. It's the first time I've had Trine Day publish it. So it's not my usual publisher. But, yeah, you can get it through them or obviously Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. Look around and get the best deal you can. I always tell people, you know, that I don't ask anybody to buy my book. It's just if your library doesn't have it, ask your library to buy it. I get a sale either way.
Okay.
So, and it's, just, you know, ask your, you know, and spread the word if you do read it, because this is going to depend a lot more on word of mouth than my books normally do. Because
and it gets soft copy and also Kindle, right?
Yeah, it's paperback and Kindle. And yeah. So hopefully a lot of people will read it, and I think if enough people do, maybe they'll start demanding answers of the people that are running our schools.
Okay, listen, well, thank you for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, Tim. Anytime. Always enjoy talking with you.
And, of course, they can also follow your work at your blog, right?
Right. DonaldJeffries.wordpress.com. I write there regularly. And the 72-year-old woman I was talking about, I wrote an article yesterday called The Story That Didn't Make It Into Bullyocracy. And I told her whole story because it really needs to be read. And Lou Rockwell picked it up on his own. So
it's LouRockwell.com. Okay. Well,
yeah, so.
Well, thank you so much. I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
Okay, then. Good night, then.
Yeah, take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.